This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. I think it's fair to say that we have always been sound enthusiasts, but over the past few months of doing this Scotland Outdoors Podcast, we've really enjoyed having the time to listen to the sounds around us and to speak to people who make it their business to share sounds with wider audiences. And to be honest, for me, it's really helped to open up my ears even more. And that probably holds true for my companion today, Helen Needham.
Oh, for sure. I feel like we've just dipped a toe into a whole new world of field recording with some of the chats we've had. Well, we always just go about recording stuff anyway, don't we? But there's a whole kind of big subject out there with lots of related theory and huge body of art as well. But I suppose the main thing is, however deep you go with the theory, it's, like you said, opening up our ears to new sounds and perhaps concepts about the world around us.
And it's astonishing what actually makes sound that we're unaware of. We've got some excellent examples in this week's podcast because our guest today is a professional artist and composer who specialises in field recordings. And he's going to take us on a very special sound journey. So a big welcome to Jez Riley French. Good morning, Jez. How are you?
I am fine, thanks.
We first came across your work through the work of a recent guest on this podcast, Jenny Sturgeon, who shared some of the field recordings she supplied for her album, The Living Mountain. Now, interestingly, like many folk involved in sound and field recordings, you've got a musical background.
I do indeed, yeah. I've been an improvising musician since the precarious young age of about 12 or 13. Through accidents and lack of skill, but wanting to make music when this whole sort of new wave thing kicked off. And that got me into improvisation. And then I progressed through various areas of music. I ran a folk distribution company for a long time, including handling all the great Scottish labels and labels from around the world. So I've always had a deep connection with music, yeah.
Do you think there is a connection between being musical and appreciating the sounds around you?
I think it certainly helps, but I don't think you need to be musical to listen to the world in interesting and creative ways. I don't think one is the ultimate pathway to the other, if you see what I mean. On a personal level, for me, because I was so young, I listened to found or located sound, if you like, as music, because I didn't really understand the differences between non-human performed sound and other sounds. So for me, that helped. It helped me get past some of the sort of theoretical discussions at first, which gave me an in to listening to the material in a certain way. The good thing about field listening, shall we say, rather than field recording at least, is that anybody can do it, as long as you've got a good pair of ears.
Yes and no, I would say, because there's some of the stuff you've recorded that, I mean, with the best will in the world, you've got no chance of actually hearing with a Mark I human ear. I mean, some of this stuff is really extraordinary. For example, tell me about the Ink Botanic project.
Yes, you're right there. I've kind of got drawn in over the years to sounds that are not available to our naked ears. So Ink Botanic is a project I've been working on for a while, and I've always been interested in recording the sounds of plants, other than what we can hear with our naked ears. So rather than the sort of rustle of trees in the wind, I was interested in listening to how trees take up water from the soil, for example. So I've used various specialist microphones that I build myself to listen to the inner sounds of trees and other plants.
Are the microphones inside the trees? Because there are some really extraordinary sounds here.
Yes, some are. Some are hydrophones, which are placed within the root system of the trees. Some are, have probes attached to them, which are inserted into the trees, carefully and without damaging the trees, I should add. Not going around chopping big holes in them. Some of the mics are just on the surface of the tree. This goes for all field recording, but the thing is, it's very chance-ridden as well. Even if you research quite heavily into what you're recording, there's still a lot of chance, a lot of, you know, because nature doesn't perform for us. And that's one thing that's, for me, that's a crucial point about listening to sounds out in the open, is they're not performing for us, you know, all these sounds. So we have to sort of step back from our position of dominance and accept that we're not in control here. So there's quite a lot of chance, you know, you can sometimes spend a good few hours trying to hear something from a tree and not hear anything, you know, because it's not predictable in that way.
Here's cherry, birch and japonica.
Very appropriate, Jez, that you've actually chosen to share the sound of pondweed. Because I've observed that many people who are into sound recording actually began their journeys in their garden, often next to a pond. How did you get into sound recording?
My mum bought me a little tape recorder, like a portable tape recorder from my 12th birthday, which was primarily to record like John Peel radio programmes off the radio. One day I was just in the garden listening back. I can't remember what I was doing there. I'm just faffing around in the garden and listening back to the sessions I'd recorded from the previous night, and I'd pressed play and record at the same time instead of just play, because those buttons were very close to each other. And it took me about 5 or 6 minutes to realise that, you know, music wasn't coming out of the recorder. So I stopped it, and because I was so young, I just rewound the tape and played it and listened to that recording out of curiosity, and I listened to it as another piece of music in a way. And of course, everything sounded radically different to what I thought the garden sounded like. Sounds were amplified. They were, you know, I was noticing things that I hadn't before. So that's how I got started. And then I just used to wander around with this little tape recorder, pressing record all the time. You know, collecting all these kind of sounds. Accident, as I think quite a lot of one's development as an artist or musician is, the good stuff is in the accidents. I think the thing of listening through microphones is so radically different, because if you've not done it before, you approach the headphones thinking, well, it'll just sound like it sounds to my ears, you know. And this, of course, microphones aren't ears; they're not as selective as we are. They don't filter out so much of the sound around us. So when you first put those headphones on and listen to sound coming through a microphone, it's like, oh my God, you know, what's all this sound? You know, it's so loud. You know?
Every year in normal times, you take people up to Glenshee on a field recording course with Chris Watson, who's also been a guest in this podcast. Tell us about the courses. How do they work?
I've taught on workshops for a long time, but we set up Memoration, which is what we call these trips, a few years ago, because we wanted to do things a bit differently. So there are elements of workshop. You know, we teach people about ambisonics and surround sound and contact mics and hydrophones and all these different technologies. But it's very much a kind of a shared communal experience, very much about coming together as a little micro community, if you like, and feeding off each other and sharing the experience. So we spend 7 days up in the Cairngorms, exploring, you know, and the location we have is ideal, because we don't have to use cars. We can walk to lots of different locations, lots of different types of habitat. It's lovely.
This next recording we're going to hear is not, well, I suppose it is in nature, but it's not a natural phenomenon. It's the Glenshee ski lift.
I've always rejected this word nature, or rather the meanings that come with it, because I think it's a word of separation. It's a them and us word, and we are nature. We're just another species amongst many, and I think that's kind of becoming increasingly important that we recognise that, obviously. So as far as I'm concerned, the ski lift is a species sound. It's something that we humans have created and put up there.
If somebody played that sound without any form of explanation, you'd have no idea what it was. Does that matter to you, Justine? What's the appeal in it for you?
Well, I suppose that's where the sort of musician or experimental musician background comes in, because there's an element of it where I'm just fascinated by the sounds rather than, you know, explain to people what they are. So I'm quite happy with people listening to it on from both angles, if you like, so just as a sonic experience. And also if people are interested in what a ski lift sounds like. there are people, believe me.
You never know, somebody might be.
No, believe me, there are lots of people around the world who spend time recording ski lifts. That's the powerful thing about sound, is it's very open. You don't have to put these definitions onto it and restrictions. You know, it's such a visceral sense that it's fine to let it just be what it is, you know.
We'll move on now from a very human metallic sound to ants. And you describe this as a durational piece. What do you mean by that?
I always work with duration. If people are interested in field recording, that is crucial. You know, the first 5 or 6 years that I was recording when I was a youngster, most of my recordings were like 2 or 3 minutes at the most. And that's often the temptation, is to record just to snatch the sound that you want. But the real treasure comes with listening for duration. With a recorder or even just with your ears, is just sitting quietly and still, listening for long durations. Because that's when you kind of start to let go of your preconceptions. So most of the time when I'm listening, I'll be there for a few hours at least. So this piece with the ants, I think the core recording of that is about 8 hours long. And I was there for a whole 24 hours, actually a bit more than that, listening to these ants.
So you stay there the whole time? You don't just leave it to record and then take it back into your studio or whatever and listen? You're there being part of it?
Yeah, I do sometimes do the sort of backing off thing where you leave your recorders and retreat to a warmer environment, shall we say. I do like to be there because for me it's about the listening. I'm still not somebody who thinks of the sound as something I have to collect. I listen, and if I'm enjoying the listening and it doesn't break the moment, sometimes I'll press record and capture some of that sound.
You must be a very, very patient person who's happy in yourself, because lots of us just would think, I can't sit there for that amount of time. It would be very difficult.
Yes, that's an interesting one. As I said, I used to run this distribution company in the music industry, and that became very stressful, and we ended up selling the business. And also it was the same time that my mum unfortunately passed away. So there was a lot of changes in my life. And what I found was is that on location listening and field recording just meant I had to stop, because you have to be still and you have to be quiet, unless you want the sounds of yourself in the piece, you know. So I don't know if I'd describe myself as patient. I'm quite a private chap and quite quiet, you know. I like a quiet kind of life, I guess. The first sort of 20 minutes are actually the hardest, because that's when all of your natural instinct to kind of move or do something are there. After 20 minutes, it's quite easy to suddenly find it's been an hour and then longer, you know.
It's not often that Helen and I disagree, but I was surprised when she said patience, because, again, it kind of presupposes that you're sitting there doing nothing. You know, you are waiting or whatever, rather, maybe you are doing something. I mean, I was thinking about somebody else who's been on this podcast some time ago, Jim Crumley, who's a wildlife writer. You know, and you read Jim's books and they're full of really extraordinary wildlife encounters where, you know, there's a peregrine falcon following an eagle and mimicking its flight pattern. That kind of thing, you know, almost taking the mickey out of it. And you think, how do you spot that? But if you read between the lines with Jim says, sat down on a wall to just look at the view, got up 3 hours later. Now, most people don't do that, but he's not sitting doing nothing. He's absorbing all the time. It's a very active process.
Yeah, it is active. This is actually quite relevant to the sort of current conversations around field recording. And not to be critical, but there's obviously a lot of people using field recording and field listening, you know, listening to environments for relaxation. That's fine, you know, that's fine. But if you're going to really listen to a location, as in rather than imposing your own ideas onto it, then it is an act. It's an active act. You know, it's not relaxing. It's quite tiring actually, because there's a lot going on. It's almost like going to see a long symphony rather than watching a 2 minute song. You know, it's the attention is quite active and draws on your resources, but that's the point of it. You know, it's the point of it is not to come out pacified; it's to come out activated by the landscape.
Oh, it's just so interesting, isn't it? Actually, because of the way that we live, so much of the time, everything's so fast paced and so immediate and quick, isn't it? This is potentially a bit of an antidote to that.
Yeah, slow listening, as they say. The thing is, when you talk about it, it does sound quite intense and everything, but it's miraculous, you know, that giving time to a place, it also involves giving time to yourself. And although it might sound to some people who haven't done it or not interested in it, it might sound crazy to sit and listen to ants for 8 hours. You know, I mean, I'm not suggesting people go out and do that necessarily. But if you just give it a bit more time than you used to, you will find that you'll hear a lot more, and your connection to those places will change. Whether it becomes stronger or not is down to your own sort of personal activism or political views, maybe on the environment, stuff like that. But you will certainly hear them differently, and that's kind of the point, isn't it? We're all learning all the time, and that's kind of crucial as well.
Is that actually a piece title? Ants eating an apricot.
It is indeed. Yeah.
It's as if, you know, and next week we're going to be ants eating a plum, you know.
Well, I have done the meeting of strawberries.
It might be different, who would know?
Yeah, no, I have done the meeting of strawberries as well, and it is different.
How and where did you record that?
That was actually for a festival in Italy, an arts festival in the Dolomites in Italy. I'd turned up to do a field recording piece. I didn't know what I was going to record, because I never do that. I tried to go to locations without expectations. But in the village square, there was this apricot tree, and obviously, because of the season, some of the apricots had fallen onto the ground and were being eaten by ants. So I just thought, well, there you go, a ready-made installation. So, So I put the set the microphones up underneath one of these the contact microphones I'm using, and set them up underneath the apricot, and then just filmed this 8-hour installation of ants devouring an apricot.
Chris Watson introduced us to the concept of contact microphones. We got very excited about it. I mean, basically, you can stick these things in acoustic instruments, you know, and basically digitise the sound. You know, pick it up that way, fine. But you can stick them in all sorts of interesting places, like underneath an apricot.
Yeah, you can indeed. Chris uses my contact mics. So contact mics I've been working with since I was a teenager, and they are remarkable. I mean, I started using them because I used to play zithers. I still play zithers. But I wanted one of those little clip-on pickups. And it was one day when I was out near a church, and I wanted to record the zither outside. And I just happened to clip this microphone onto a fence, and it picked up the vibration of the fence. And it was like, what's that? And why does it sound better than my zither playing, you know? So contact mics are great. Yeah, you can put them... Just because just about everything makes a sound, you know, that's the thing.
Field recordings, I mean, when we spoke to Chris, he was talking about having recorded, you know, 20 years apart, the sound of a coral reef being denuded. One recording was very rich, very full, very active. And then 20 years later, you heard it and you thought, dear me, you know, I mean, that's obviously quite a lot of degradation there. Do you record occasionally with environmental purpose to do that and to demonstrate that kind of thing?
Well, the easiest way for me to answer that is intuition has been crucial to the way I work. So I try not to arrive to places with too many expectations or ideas and too many sort of philosophies and standpoints. But inevitably, if you're recording locations that you've visited a few times, you know, or even for the first time, then those aspects do come into it. You can't help but think about environmental impact and things like that. So I'd say that, yes, I do, but my process is to be as open as possible first and then see where the environment leads me, if you see what I mean.
Can you talk us into the next sound that we're going to hear? This is Dissolve.
Yeah, so that's a good example of that. I was asked to create a piece for a festival in the Dolomites, and when I arrived at the festival, it was pretty obvious to me that they'd hired a field recordist artist rather than me, because I think they wanted the kind of bird tweeting and very nice, kind of pleasant sound. But I was more interested in the Dolomites themselves, the actual geological structure of the mountains. So I chipped bits off the Dolomites and then dissolved them in acid. You know, why not? You know, but I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, in all minerals there is air trapped in there. You know, from millennia old air trapped in these rocks, and I wanted to access that, see what it sounded like. And the environmental aspect, the political aspect of it, is that I made the solution that I was dissolving them in 0.005% more acidic than the rainfall in that region at that time. So it's literally saying, we're not that far off from literally dissolving mountains, you know. So what you're going to hear now is the sound of a small piece of the Dolomites dissolving in this very light acidic solution.
This business about the release of trapped air causing sound, about 15 years or so ago, Helen and I did a programme up in Greenland. And at one stage, we took a trip out on a fishing boat with a skipper car. I think it was called Torkild. And he says, oh, yeah. He says, you know, says, sometimes we put the glacier ice into whiskey. And I said, well, by a strange coincidence, friend, I have a bottle of whiskey in my rucksack. So I took the bottle of whiskey out and, he got a couple of glasses and what have you. And he leant over the side of the boat and he fished out a piece of clear ice. And then he chipped it off and he put it in and he said, now listen. You know, and I actually recorded the sound of this pinking and tinging and, you know, just the sound of the air escaping from the ice as it fractured, you know, and released this air. And he said, listen, says, the ice is singing. He says, and while the ice is singing, you are never drinking alone. It's perfect. But as you say, just about everything creates a sound. It's extraordinary.
That's the thing. I don't know if I can put this in the right words, but it's extraordinary, but absolutely as it should be. I mean, why do we assume things don't make sound? You know, it's like this we're viewing the world from a human perspective, assuming things don't make sound if we can't hear them with our naked ears all the time. And of course they do. There's vibration everywhere. You know, the world turning creates vibration. So there's always that resonance happening throughout any structure, any environment.
But ice particularly makes a lot of sound. And you recorded this in Iceland. This is Fjallsalen.
Fjallsalen is a small glacial lake just behind Jökulsárlón, which is the most famous glacial lake in Iceland. And it's like tourist central at Jökulsárlón. There's, you know, coaches arriving every 5 minutes. And they have speedboats on Jökulsárlón, which go around chipping bits of ice off the glacier for people to put in vodka. But Fjallsárlón, which is only a few hundred metres away, behind that one was always the secret one where the Icelanders themselves went when they wanted to get away from the tourists. And the week we were there recording, they were building the huts for a motorboat service on that lake as well. And that was the last glacial lake in Iceland without a motorboat service on it for tourists. So now, unfortunately, you wouldn't hear that unless the motorboats had stopped, because all you'd hear was the engine noise of the motorboats. But what we're hearing is lumps of glacier that have carved off into this lake, and then they're drifting out towards the sea. Again, it's this sound of 20,000-year-old air being released from the ice as it dissolves.
The sound of 20,000-year-old air being released from Iceland ice, as recorded by Jez Riley French. We hope that you enjoyed hearing some of Jez's weird and wonderful sounds in this edition of Scotland Outdoors. Now, Jez was very kind enough to share even more sounds with us, which we'll save for our midweek edition next week, so please be sure to listen out for that. In the meantime, if you'd like to learn more about his work, visit his website at jezrileyfrench, that's all one word, .co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham, and the extremely talented Jez Riley French, thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.